The case we're going to have today is case number 57287, Brian Edward Cox, the appellant versus the state of Nevada respondent. This is a criminal case. In fact, Judge Davis, may he rest in peace, is the judge who handled this case for the judiciary. And first of all, I'm going to ask my colleague, Justice Gibbons, to say, how do we get here, besides in your car? How does a case get here to the Supreme Court?
Thank you, Justice Jerry. Again, ladies and gentlemen, you're here in session with the Nevada Supreme Court. What we do is we hear cases which have previously gone to the district court, which is the trial court, usually been decided either by a judge or by a jury. So once they make the decision, then the party who loses the case is not happy with the result and feels that there were some legal errors committed either by the judge or by the jury, they have an absolute right to appeal to the Nevada Supreme Court. And that's where we come in. We don't hear witnesses, we don't have juries here. What we do is do arguments with the attorneys representing each side, and they come in and explain to us why they feel there was either a mistake or that the judge was correct or the jury was correct in the particular rulings. Once we hear the oral arguments, we don't decide the case today. I mean, what we have to do is the three of us have to go back and meet, consider the arguments raised by each side, and study the law and legal arguments that the parties have submitted to us in writing, and then all our decisions are made in writing by the Supreme Court. We don't do anything orally. If we make a written decision, we file it and send it to the attorneys. So that's basically in a nutshell how the Supreme Court operates as far as this panel is concerned.
And Justice Pickering, after we have oral argument, what does this panel do?
We listen to both sides of the dispute here, and one of the cases that's in the news lately, the Amanda Knox appeal, may have been something that you all have seen. Let's pause for a minute while the students come in. Welcome. We were just discussing with the students how this works and what the Supreme Court of Nevada does as opposed to the trial court level. You all see on TV trial court type proceedings where a witness is on the stand and the lawyer is cross-examining the witness and the jury is sitting there debating how to decide how the case will come out. There are rules of evidence and rules of procedure, but the questions are mostly factual at the district or trial court level. If somebody's unhappy with the case, they can appeal it. And Justice Gibbons just went through that for the group here. And what I was saying when you came in was that in our system, an appeal does not involve rehearing any of the witnesses. So when this case is submitted at the end of today, when these two lawyers make their arguments, we won't hear anything more than what they're saying to us today. There are no new witnesses. We don't hear new facts. We can't say, well, we want to hear some evidence here. We're not sure, you know, really what happened. We'd like to hear from this witness or that. That does not happen in our American system. And it's different from the Italian system where those of you who followed the Amanda Knox appeal, she essentially was vindicated on appeal as a result of new evidence. We don't take any new evidence at all. What we do at the end of today's proceeding, the lawyers have come and they've filed briefs, and their briefs argue what they contend were errors of law committed in the district court. They bring those errors of law to us, and they argue that under the rule of law, there was a mistake made, and this defendant should either go free or he should receive a new trial. The state, for its side, argues that that is incorrect, that the district court judge, John Davis, did everything appropriately, no errors were made, the judgment of conviction and the sentence should be appealed. And what we do when we're done listening to this and reading the briefs and looking at the law is the three of us get together and we discuss among ourselves how we feel this case should come out. And there are different ways it can come out, but it's either generally an affirmance, meaning the judgment stands and the conviction stands, or it's a reversal and what we call a remand for a new trial, so the whole program goes over again, the state would get to try the defendant again, or in some instances it's an outright reversal and an acquittal, meaning that there was not enough evidence or there was some other reason that this defendant who was convicted in the trial court should go free. And this case presents those questions. Sometimes we don't all agree with one another, and there's a reason that appellate panels sit in odd numbers, because if we don't agree, we might have a dissent, so it could be a 2-to-1 vote. In our written orders or opinions, we explain why we come out the way we did, and if there's a dissent, the dissent gets to weigh in and say, you know, I disagree with my colleague's reading of the law. What's interesting, though, is unlike arguments that you may have with friends or family members, we really strive to be polite with one another and to respect the opposing points of view. What we're trying to do is to show people how we consider the law applies to the facts that were presented and to explain ourselves so that people know they've been heard and heard fairly according to the rule of law and not according to who they were or who they knew or anything else. Everybody is supposed to get the same treatment. So that's what we do in a nutshell.
Thank you. Thank you, Justice Pickering. Thank you, Justice Gibbons. To the new muckers that have just come in, welcome. I'm Associate Chief Justice Michael Cherry. This is my colleague, Justice Mark Gibbons, and my other colleague, Justice Christina Pickering. Now, the full court of the Supreme Court of Nevada is 7 members. We have 2 ladies, Christina Pickering and Nancy Seda, and then we have 5 gentlemen, Justice Gibbons, myself, Justice Michael Douglas, Justice Jim Hardesty, Justice Ron Perigary. I think I named everybody. Yeah, I did. I can count to 5. I'm getting good here. So there's 7 of us. But in order to handle more cases, we divide up into panels. This is called the Northern Panel. We hear cases from the rural areas, rural counties, Washoe County, and what we call overflow Clark County, because Clark County produces most of the cases to us, so we take a number of Clark County cases. And what we do is sometimes when we have Clark County cases, we actually go to Las Vegas, to the Regional Justice Center, and most of the time we hear our cases in Carson City as a panel. Well, Justice Gibbons, when I came on the court in 2007, and since 2008 when I've been the presiding justice of the Northern Panel, said, you know, a lot of the high school students would really like to see what this is about, the judiciary is about. And we do actual cases. And we've been to West Wendover, Ely, Elko, Sparks, Fallon, Reno, Pahrump. We were in Pinaki yesterday. And we've even been to 2 high schools in Las Vegas. But we saved the best for last, which is, of course, Tonopah and the Muckers. Well, we're glad to be here. And we have an actual case. This is an actual case where somebody actually got convicted. That person has appealed. His lawyer is here, and the lawyer for the state of Nevada is here. And what I do in this particular situation, usually both sides get 15 minutes each, so that our oral argument is about 30 minutes. And the appellant, the one who represents the person who was convicted, can save part of that 15 minutes for rebuttal. But what I do, and one of the selling points we have to the lawyers to come to the various rural areas to do their cases, is I allow them to tell the audience about the facts of the case, which gives them a little extra time. So I'd like to introduce for the appellant, Christopher Arobia, who will represent Mr. Cox, and for the respondent, State of Nevada, John Field Jr., who will represent the state. So, Mr. Arobia, if you would tell the audience, the students and faculty and our guests, what your case is about, and then we have Mr. Field also tell about the facts as he sees them for the state of Nevada.
Thank you.
And if you just face them, you can please do.
Good morning. My name is Chris Arabia. I represent
Brian Cox was the appellant, which means that we were the losers of the trial, and we're the ones who are unhappy with one of the rulings, and that's why we're here now. This case is kind of complicated because the trial that led to this appeal was for an offense called unlawful possession of a firearm. Whether I know, if you ever become convicted of a felony, it's illegal for you to have a firearm, because that's one in any way, and that's the offense in question. But there was a larger issue. Mr. Cox has also been accused of attempted murder. There was a stabbing, and there's going to be a trial on that at some point in the future. And the issues on the appeal, I don't want to get too much into them right now, but there's a thing called corpus selecti, which means the body of the crime, the core of the crime, that was one of the issues. And then there was another issue regarding, can you mention the attempted homicide accusation at the trial for the firearm possession? But the main thing is that he was accused of possessing the firearm. He was convicted by the jury. And during the course of the proceedings today, you'll get to hear our argument as to why we think that should be undone. And then, of course, Mr. Friel will make the argument for the state. And that's my factual summary. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robia. Mr. Friel?
Thank you. Just to let you know that those are not muggers that came in at the end. Those are hornets from the high school, I believe.
Thank you very much. Is there a harness, did you say?
Hornets.
Well, I heard about that. Is there mucker spirit still here? And forgive me, is there hornets spirit here also? Spirit here? Mr. Friel, you're a lifesaver. Now, that doesn't give you any advantage in this case, by the way. Mine was a harmless error.
It's an honor to be here. I know a lot of you usually would see me sitting over there coaching basketball, but this is what I mean. Again, unusual case. We have attempted murder, somebody got stabbed, and we go to trial because it just happened to have a gun. And we try to present our case without saying yes to it. And the issue of this case basically was, was there evidence other than what the defendant said that led us to convict him? Very unusual case. We didn't find out about the case like you usually do. You find out that there was a crime, and then you then try to find out who did it. This case was almost the total opposite. Just the way they put the facts. So like I said, it's an honor for me to be here from the high school to be able to, tell you what I do, show you what I do. My kids are here. In fact, I thought it was my wife. So. It's an honor. This is unusual thing. This is a very formal thing. This is important. A guy's liberty is at stake. There was a conviction, he went to prison. So there's a lot of value on it, and just an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gould. Now, once we conclude final argument, the attorneys will remain and we'll have some Q&A. And so that'll be interesting to see what type of questions you'll have about the judiciary and about the criminal law, administration of the criminal law system. Are you prepared to go for appellate?
May it please the court. My name is Chris Arabia, and I represent the appellant Brian Cox in this matter. And the central contention in our appeal is that the state did not satisfy the requirements of the corpus selecti doctrine. And as you know, this doctrine refers to the body of the crime or the core of the crime. And what it means, as you stated in the Edwards decision, is that this corpus selecti, the body of the crime, must be established independent of out-of-court or extrajudicial admissions before those admissions can come in.
Yeah, Mr. Rabbi, we're not talking about a human body here. The word body means the components of the crime. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
and I appreciate the chance to clarify. The term "oddly" comes from the Latin. What it really means is there independent evidence that the crime itself occurred outside of the statements or admissions? And so the admissions have to sort of be taken and put to the side, and then we look at what's left. And if what's left is sufficient, then the statements can come in, but not before. And our contention is that did not happen here. The actual core of the offense, because of the nature of ex con and possession of a firearm, is was there an ex con who possessed a firearm? And taking the admissions, as I said, and putting them to the side, we then have to look at the evidence that remains in a light most favorable, in this case, to the state. So what we have was a person, Brian Cox, possessing a background that was described to the child as black with a brown tag. There was no gun seen by anyone, and that was it for Brian Cox's part. 6 days later, on the side of Route 376, there was a black and gray, as it was described at the trial, backpack recovered, and there was a pistol in that backpack and some other items. But there was nothing in the backpack that would link it to Brian Cox. There was no physical evidence connecting the firearm to him. There was nothing. There was no link. So given those two things, there wasn't enough to establish the corpus delicti. On the one hand, we have a person with a black backpack with a brown tag. On the other hand, we have a black and gray backpack with a pistol in it with no link to Brian Cox. And based on that, the state did not establish the corpus delicti crime. And so the objection that we made at the trial should have been sustained. We made it at the moments that statements were introduced, and then again towards the end of the trial. And so our contention was that the admission of these statements was error.
What were the statements of your client that you're referring to as admissions that were entered into evidence?
There was testimony that on the evening in question, he told a gentleman by the name of Justin Stevenson that he had a gun, and then there was a statement made to Detective Down, who was actually here with us this morning, that he had a pistol in the backpack. Those were the two statements.
Did Mr. Stevenson testify that he knew that Mr. Cox customarily or frequently carried a gun and that it was a .22 caliber gun?
That's partially correct. The actual testimony, which was on page 62 of the appellate's appendix, was that Stevenson had seen Cox with a pistol. The exact quote was quite a few times. I think that's a little different than frequently, because he also testified that he had known Cox for as long as 5 years, and quite a few times, could be 7 or 8 times over 5 years, which would be very infrequent, whereas frequently sort of applies to me anyway all the time. But yes, there was testimony that was similar to that.
Okay.
Did Mr. Cox, where was the backpack relative to where Mr. Cox lives? This occurred out near Carver's, correct?
Yes. I don't remember the exact distance. It would have been more than a couple miles, I don't think. So it wasn't like it was right next door to his residence, but at the same time, it wasn't like it was in Ely or something like that.
Am I incorrect in understanding that Mr. Cox lived in the Carver's RV park and that the backpack was found across Highway 376 near the Carver's RV park?
My recollection is that he didn't live in the park. He did have a grandmother who lived nearby, and he did stay there sometimes. And then from the scene where the allegation of the stabbing, where that came from was, I drove it, and it wasn't very far. I just don't remember the exact distance, but a couple minutes in a car, probably.
Thanks.
Okay. Mr. Robert, maybe we could go back a second where you said that Mr. Cox spoke to the officer about it during the investigative stage of this particular offense, and then for the students now, and you might explain that if a police officer stops you, was your client obligated to make any statements at that time?
May I turn to Russell?
Yes.
You may have heard about, for instance, on TV when they read some of their rights and that sort of thing. The police have certain protections that they must give to defendants such as Brian Cox. This was not the situation on Law and Order where the police ran up and grabbed someone. What happened is, after being savvy, eventually word filtered back to Brian Cox about what had happened, and he made arrangements to surrender himself, which he did to the detective, and then the detective, when they were driving out, Mr. Cox advised the detective that he wanted to discuss mainly the other incident. The detective did make sure that he was aware of his rights. They had a conversation, and then towards the end of that conversation, Brian said that he might have an attorney, at which point the detective stops discussing the offense, recognizing that Brian didn't have the right to have an attorney, and that was sort of what happened. Generally, the officer, in order to do an interrogation, if the officer feels that this person is potentially involved in a crime, has to give him that warning, and then it's up to the person, in this case, Cox, to decide the length at which they wish to discuss the situation, and that was done here.
So, just to recap, then, when the police stop somebody, they don't have to read them their rights, generally until they're in custody or under arrest. So they ask them questions about what happened. The person can decline to answer. But once they say they're under arrest or they place handcuffs on them, then they have to say you have a right to remain silent, you have a right to an attorney. And if anybody says, I'd like to talk to an attorney, the police have to stop the questioning immediately. Is that right?
Absolutely.
We stopped the clock while you were addressing this witness. Could you explain to me how this... My understanding is that your client told the police that he had lost his backpack in the area near the Carver's RV park. Could you explain to me what the record shows with respect to that?
In discussing the stabbing, Mr. Cox told Detective Downing that he had gone back to the area because he had dropped a backpack at the actual scene in the Carver's RV park. And that was why he went back. And then there were a bunch of other events that went on regarding the stabbing. And his statement to Detective Downing, as I recall, was that he had retrieved the backpack, but then he didn't know where it was.
So why would that not tie the backpack found in the desert to him sufficiently under the corpus delicti? Well, I understand that finding the backpack in the desert by itself would not amount to proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but finding the backpack in proximity to his home, coupled with his statement that he had lost his backpack and was going to retrieve it, should be sufficient to tie that to him, should it not? And if not, why not?
I don't believe that it should, only because I think in the Edwards decision, the principle there is, and this goes into the policy reasons for the corpus delicti doctrine, which I know they call an email, but I just want to briefly mention them for the benefit of the audience.
Yeah, please do. Explain to them why the law keeps out a defendant's confession or admissions unless there's corroborating evidence.
May I?
Yes.
Thank you. What we were just discussing is this issue of the corpus delicti doctrine and why a statement by someone suspected of a crime might be kept out. And there are a number of reasons for it. It protects against false confessions. protects against coerced confessions. It protects against possible abuse by the police. It also requires the police to go a little further and establishing that a crime definitely happened before a statement can be tossed out. And there have been a lot of cases. This actually is an important principle. For example, some people have been exonerated by DNA when they were convicted largely based on confessions, and the jury is going to give credit to a confession where it turns out that the crime didn't happen or happened much differently. We have to be cautious about that. And then there's an example from history, which I mentioned in the trial, and we're a long way from this in this country, but in Soviet Russia in the 1930s, they didn't have these kind of protections, and a lot of people, more than a million, were executed basically based on coerced and false confessions. That would be the entirety of the evidence. And here, like I said, we're a long way from that. I don't think we should take even one step in that direction. We want to make sure that it's established that the crime actually happened by evidence other than the defendant's own words, before those words then can come in to bolster the case.
Thanks, that was helpful. My question was, and it remains, why, given that the backpack was found in the desert across the street where, from the Carver's RV park, and your client had told the police he had lost his backpack and was worried about it, that should not come in, both of those together, and it's for the jury to decide whether or not it was fair to attribute that backpack with that weapon in it to him.
Well, I think that was a very good question, and I'll try to answer it in two parts. One is, the record of the trial is that we had a black backpack with a brown tag on it. That was his backpack. This backpack was black and gray. And there was nothing to tie the contents to Brian Cox. There was no fingerprint evidence, no DNA, nothing of the kind. So, but that's kind of looking at this, I think, under the collaboration rule, which is sort of the competitor of corpus selecti. Under corpus selecti, the statements that he made, no matter what they are, have to be set aside, and then all the initial analysis permits is an examination of the other evidence. And if you take a person with a black backpack or a brown tag, and then 6 days later, there's a black and gray backpack in the desert with no links to Brian Cox, their corpus selecti hasn't been established. The only way that the linkage could be established was by the admissions that were attributed to Cox.
Now, ordinarily, in ex felon possession of firearm cases, they're fairly easy to prove. Usually the state proves that the person is an ex felon, and then usually the evidence is customarily that the person has a firearm on them. In this particular case, it's a little different, but why would you try this case before you would try the stabbing case?
My recollection of that was that Judge Davis, may rest in peace, decided that that was the order that we were going to do it in, and we've negotiated periodically since this happened. It happened quite a while ago. We haven't been able to resolve the other case, and so the trial for this case was set for 3 months after the incident, and I think we were just following the judge's orders.
And why would, a little learning experience for the students and the audience, why do we sever out the ex-felon in possession of a firearm case from a stabbing case or whatever else it's related to?
Matt?
Yes, and we'll stop the clock again.
That's another good question from the justices. When you have a trial, one of the key rights that we have in this country is obviously that we don't have to testify. It's taking the fifth, is how it's more commonly described. And as part of that, if the defendant doesn't testify in a trial, which Mr. Cox did not on this one, in a trial, the fact that Mr. Cox had a previous felony conviction wouldn't be able to come in because it might prejudice the jury against them. However, one of the many unique features of the ex-felon possession of a firearm charge is obviously ex-felon. It's part of the crime, so it comes in, which means if you have a situation like this where you pretty much have two separate offenses. There's the stabbing allegation and the ex-felon possession of a firearm allegation. You can't do the trial together because the first thing the jury would find out is that Mr. Cox is an ex-felon, and that could affect his rights in the stabbing trial, and that's why the trials had to be separated.
We can start the clock again. Now, my next question is, since the ex-felon is severed out, why would evidence of the stabbing come in to the ex-felon trial?
Why would it?
Well, I know it did, and why do you claim it's error? Why is it error?
All right, now, I want to clarify a couple of things. I made a motion to eliminate it as denied. I reviewed it on the morning of the trial, and what happened here...
A motion to eliminate is a pretrial motion that some piece of evidence is not going to be admitted before the jury.
Right, and what we wanted is, sort of taking the reason for bifurcating the trial to prevent the reference to his felon status at the stabbing trial and sort of flipping it, we didn't want the reference to the stabbing in the ex-felon trial, and what happened here, unfortunately, was that the evidence bags still had attempted homicide written on them, and it was in the declaration that I filed as part of the appellant's appendix. Two of the jurors did say that they found that to be bothersome. At the same time, in fairness, I'm not attributing any malice or any kind of impropriety to Mr. Friel or to the state. And I know Mr. Friel definitely made a very good faith effort to keep references to the stabbing out, but unfortunately they came in, and the central issue here is how did that affect Mr. Cox's rights. And the problem is that the jury deliberated, they asked for a readback of testimony. This was actually a reasonably close case, I would infer from that, so that any prejudice against him could have swung the outcome.
Mr. Reagan, I'm curious about how much time was presented at the trial. If you could give a percentage about the stabbing evidence versus the possession of the firearm evidence. And in closing argument, was there any reference to the stabbing case? Would you let me know about that?
I would say it was about 99.99% to just that fact that the word attempted homicide, or it was ATT period homicide, was written on the evidence bags that were given to the jury. I don't think that Mr. Friel ever mentioned it, and in fairness to him, I'm happy to point that out. So it was 99% plus on the firearm. There was just that one thing that the jury was exposed to.
Recently, within the last year or two, there's been two Supreme Court opinions, actually the same last name, called Fields versus State. One was written by Justice Sherry and one by Justice Pickering, discussing this other bad acts, you know, when it's allowed, not allowed. There were other issues, and that was a murder case, but there were other issues. But did either of those opinions fall into this particular case in your mind?
I'll be honest with you, I came at this strictly as an appropriate versus prejudice issue.
Okay.
And because the bad acts were contemporaneous, I wouldn't be able to address that. I'm sorry.
Did the jury hear evidence other than the notations on the evidence bags related to the stabbing?
No, the references were very...
There was an incident,
there was an incident, or there was a cause to go and apprehend Brian Cox, that kind of thing.
So if the evidence bags with the labeling had not come in, you would not have an error argument associated with the denial of your motion in limine, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
So the motion was denied, but meanwhile, the only evidence that really came in was the evidence bags having attempted murder on them or attempted homicide or whatever.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. You have about 17 seconds left. I'm going to give you some extra time for rebuttal since we peppered you with questions. So I'll give you an extra 2 minutes in rebuttal.
I'll reserve time so I can come back then as well. But I'll just say my piece now. I think that that when you, the important thing is conceptually it's difficult to take the admissions and sort of put them over to the side and then look at the rest of the evidence, because you can't consider any of the content of those statements. Well, you can, but I'm saying that under corpus delicti, I don't believe that you should. And I think that the state, in relying on...
Go ahead and finish your thought.
In relying on Doyle, slightly misplaced the reasonable inference test in Doyle, because the evidence in Doyle was overwhelming with even without the statements, whereas here this wasn't the case.
Thank you. I'm going to still give you 2 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Friel, we'd like to hear your interpretation of the corpus delicti rule from a prosecutor's standpoint of view.
Corpus delicti is a fancy word. Basically, what we're trying to tell you is that there has to be something other. We have to prove his client was an ex-felon with some other admissible evidence other than he said he had a gun, and there's no connection that he's a felon. So, corpus delicti, was there a crime committed? Was it committed by his client? That's basically what we're trying to do, and was there evidence independent of him saying that he had a backpack with a gun? And that's basically the issue in this case.
Thank you. We'll start the clock now.
Ladies and court, John Friel, representing the state of Nevada. One thing I wanted to point out that Mr. Olavia said was the first testimony about his client having a gun came from Mr. Stevenson, but that then did not come out of a question that I asked. It came out of a question that Mr. Olavia asked. He basically, on cross-examination, asked him to basically restate his testimony, and your testimony is that Brian said he had a gun. And we're not trying to hide the fact that there was a stabbing, but as you look at the transcript, I don't believe I ever said it, and Mr. Arabia trying to explain this case, he mentioned the stabbing several times, because, I mean, that was the element in the room that we were ignoring. And the motion in limine, he asked generally that any other evidence of that crime would not be allowed. And my argument was that we have to be able to tell the story as we know it. And to be able to tell the story as we know it, it may have been necessary to have testimony that there was a stabbing. We did everything we could not to mention that, because we didn't want a conviction based on something other than the evidence that we presented. We didn't want to convict him of being an ex-felon in possession of a firearm because there was testimony that he stabbed someone. That's a separate case.
And Mr. Friel, that general rule of the courts that developed through our case law and court decisions is because if somebody's charged with a crime, the jury's supposed to hear about that particular crime. And with certain exceptions, they're not supposed to hear about other maybe bad things that a person accused of crime has done. So you agree that's the general rule, unless the court allows other evidence.
Correct, because if he's a bad guy that stabs somebody, he must have done the other thing that we accuse him of. And we try to avoid that. And I've had experience before with, it's very damning evidence, but it's so prejudicial that more likely than not, I'm going to be standing in front of the Supreme Court trying to explain something, and then the case gets taken back to the district court, and we start over. And I did everything in this case to avoid having that happen.
Now, are you familiar with the case of the opinion State versus John Fields and State versus Linda Fields, opinions issued by the Supreme Court? I don't know if you feel they might have any play in this particular case.
I don't think so, because we didn't use the bad evidence. It was out there, but we didn't use it. We didn't say that he stabbed him. The testimony is that the police were called early in the morning to Carver's RV park. And just to let everybody know, the testimony is, it's a two-lane highway. Carver's RV park is on one side, and the gun was found on the other side, basically in a spot close enough that this Jim would hold it. The testimony, basically, we went in order. Stevenson said he saw Mr. Cox with a backpack. He was familiar with the backpack. He was familiar that Mr. Cox customarily kept a .22 pistol in that backpack.
And Stevenson mentioned the caliber of the pistol, so that came from Stevenson's memory of his dealings with Cox, not something that Cox said to him.
Correct.
So Stevenson's testimony was he knew that Cox had a .22 pistol and often had it with him, and he asked him, "Do you have it tonight?"
And yes.
And
on cross-examination, he said yes, that he did tell him that he had.
And the pistol in the backpack across from RV Park was a .22
pistol.
Okay.
Part of the argument that there was nothing to tie the defendant to that backpack. The person that found the backpack was riding on a horse. We didn't make that up. And found a backpack. And that by itself means nothing. Other than he knew, and he testified that he knew the sheriff's office was looking for a backpack in that area. So when he saw the backpack, he called the sheriff's office.
Okay, we have a case called Edwards versus State decided in 2006 that your opposing colleague relies on heavily, and justifiably so. And for the students, cases are decided and published with reference to other cases so that the same rules of law apply to each person. And this Edwards case is very significant to this case because Mr. Arabia's position is that it controls and entitles his client to essentially acquittal because there wasn't enough evidence to tie him to that backpack, to that gun. Can you distinguish this Edwards case for us and tell us why it's different from the case we have here?
Well, in the Edwards case, there was a gun found, and the defendant said he moved that gun into the evidence.
It was in an apartment?
Right, and that was all the evidence. In this case, we had a person saying that he... we kind of have to start from the end. We found a backpack with a gun, a .22 gun in it. Then we went back. Had anybody seen that backpack before? Yes, Mr. Stevenson had saw that the night that they were together, the night that the cops were called, Mr. Cox had that backpack, and he told him he had a gun.
But Mr. Stevenson did not identify the backpack at trial as the backpack he saw Mr. Cox carrying on the night in question, did he?
He did not. And like I said, the gun was admitted without objection. But the fact that this man that found the backpack was actually basically, he knew that they were looking for a backpack. The reason we know about the backpack is that, of course, from the statement from the defendant that he went back to the scene, basically, of whatever happened with the stabbing. Because he had a backpack, and the reason that he had to go back to get that backpack was because it had a gun in it, and he's a felon. And I think it's relevant that the testimony from the detective was that the defendant didn't tell him exactly where the backpack was. That caused the delay in finding the backpack, and when they reread the detective's testimony, that's what they were basically waiting to hear to confirm that, yes, the deputy testified that the defendant told him that that was his backpack, that had the gun they found with the backpack they found with the gun was his. And like I said, it was found by somebody that just happened to know that they were looking for that backpack. And I think based on that, you can make a reasonable inference that the guy's in a small area looking for a backpack that was left by Mr. Cox, that that's Mr. Cox's backpack.
There's some suggestion in the commentary that the corpus delicti rule applied especially to statutory crimes and ex felon in possession is essentially a statutory crime, not like the older murder crimes, that that doctrine really doesn't make sense in light of the protection afforded by the Fifth and Sixth Amendments and the test of voluntariness and the other indications that courts look for constitutionally that a confession was fairly obtained and should be admissible, and that the corpus delicti rule is sort of archaic and should be set to one side. Could you comment on that and what your position is with respect to that?
Well, I think that it's easier to apply cases different from this. Usually it's a murder case where you're trying to establish that there was a murder, some unlawful act that caused somebody to die, and the corpus delicti rule, as is described in other cases, doesn't fit real cleanly with ex felon in possession. And this is one of the cases you talked about, having this the ex felon part of the case severed from the attempted murder case. And if there was ever a case, I don't think it was necessary, it's this case. Like I said, the reason that it was, that this case went first, the judge said this case is going to go first. Mr. Arabi tried not to have that happen, and it was partly, I think, it was a matter of, we can do this ex felon case, and one day this other case is going to be long ways back. But part of the stabbing case, and the defense to that would be self-defense.
Now, let me ask you a hypothetical on things. Let's say somebody abducted somebody here in Tonopah and killed him and dropped him down a mine shaft, and the body wasn't recovered, and the person confessed to killing this person, but there's no other evidence and all like that. Could you prosecute a case like that? And if so, how would you go about it?
Are you talking about hypothetical?
Yeah. I hope there's not a real case like that, but I mean,
you may have some cases
like that. If there is a real case like that, drop it. A lot of times, ladies, we don't know about pending cases in district court, so I may ask a question that might have an impact on something else that we don't really want to go into. So.
Probably 15 years ago, there was something similar to that body never found, and that case was heavily, we had to rely on an eyewitness.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's got to be something other than him saying he did it.
But that is sort of the classic corpus delicti case where you wouldn't even know a crime had occurred but for the defendant's admission, correct?
Correct. We're not trying to hide that. That's just the way we found out about it.
But Mr. Arabia's side of this is the central element of this, in addition to being an ex-felon, is possession, and that the only way you prove possession is his statement to the police, I left my backpack in the desert, I was going to go get it, and I was worried about it because it had a gun in it. His point is you don't have enough independent of that statement to prove up possession.
Right.
And your position is that you do, and this is not the Edwards case.
Right, and he has to make an inference from the other evidence that he had that Mr. Stevenson saw him in the backpack that night and knew he had a gun. Customarily had a gun, and we found the backpack that had a gun in it. I think that's the judge made a ruling that I think is reasonable under the circumstances that was the backpack.
The jurisprudence in the state, as far as something going back to jury deliberations that they're really not entitled to, usually results in a reversal. Why doesn't this result in a reversal as far as the attempted homicide on the evidence bags, instead of it being redacted? Why would you, as a prosecutor, not say to the judge, "Hey, judge, let's redact that. Let's not let the jury see that."
Because it never came out until this appeal. I mean, and I don't think you have to consider that that evidence. Because it's not part of the record. It wasn't objected to. It wasn't brought to the court's attention. It's basically after the fact that Mr. Arabia brought that up. And again, those bags came in without objection. Not on purpose. It was just... But I don't think you have to rely that anybody relied on them because there's... We don't have any evidence that somebody actually did look at them. There's no evidence that anybody was bothered by that. It's just
a statement out there that came after the fact.
Maybe we could change facts in our hypothetical. Well, let's say here, instead of the gun being found in a backpack out on the highway, let's say you had this evidence came in and Mr. Cox came investigated for crime, and you think that the gun might be at his house or his apartment, wherever he's living. Would the police have the right to go into the apartment and look for the gun, or would they maybe have to contact maybe Judge Sullivan or somebody like that to get a search warrant to go into the house? How does that proceed?
Well, first of all, we ask them for permission. That's the cleanest way. Can we, especially, that's the cleanest way. Can we go in just to see if it's there or not? Sometimes that happens, sometimes it's not. But as a prosecutor, like I said, we don't like doing things twice. If the best way is to get a warrant, obviously we have to have probable cause for the judge to sign off on that. But yeah.
And a homeowner has the right to say, no, you may not come in. And that, too, is not admissible that they denied you access and asked you to go get a warrant, correct?
Right. Again, that's not this case, but we're talking about this is a very unusual case. That, guy riding a horse on his backpack in the desert. And then the other thing was there was some mention again that it was out in the middle of the desert, and I think the testimony is clear that it was maybe in some sagebrush, but in close proximity where Mr. Stevenson and Mr. Cox had recently been.
But the police had done a grid search where they thought it might be and not found the backpack. Is that fair?
That was also based on information that Mr. Cox gave.
I have a similar question, another kind of hypothetical from this. Let's say the Mr. Cox was being questioned by the officer. He at the beginning says, I don't want to talk to you. And then the trial came up and he was charged. Could you comment to the jury that Mr. Cox had a chance to explain his position to the police and declined to do so? So maybe he's hiding something? Could you say something like that?
If I said something like that, Mr. Robert would jump out of his chair and jack, and the judge would just basically emphasize that not only is that improper, that everybody knows that it's improper, so it wouldn't happen.
Excellent answer. Thank you very much, Mr. Creel. I'll give you a couple minutes in rebuttal. And what about the evidence bags? The attempted homicide.
I want to be clear on that, that although I did attempt the motion to eliminate it two times, the evidence bag itself during the trial, I missed it, and I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't. That was my mistake. It should have penalized Brian Cox. And that's pretty much that. And I don't want anything that I said to be interpreted as impugning Mr. Creel's motives, because I don't think that he intended to do that. I think support for that position is found in the fact that he didn't really mention the stabbing during the trial. It's an unfortunate situation. I don't think anyone is directly to blame. As far as the rebuttal, there were a few things I wanted to emphasize. When the state characterizes Dustin Stevenson as saying that Cox frequently or customarily carried the pistol, I just want to be clear that what he said actually was quite a few times, which can be, it's an indeterminate number, but I think 7 or 8 qualified, and that's over a period as long as 5 years. So I don't think any word that allows an inference of nearly always or always is appropriate. And I think that the state and the district court both are operating under the collaboration rule and not corpus delicti. At the trial, the state said the conviction can be based solely on admissions of defendant, and the court said, privately said, and can't arrest his conviction on the back of what he said there. He has said more than that. Those statements, at first glance, might sound or look similar, but they are far broader than the actual standard, which is admissions over here, corpus delicti has to be proven independently. And I think that already we have the arguments that the Fifth and Sixth Amendment protections have rendered corpus delicti obsolete, I don't think that's really true. I think the corpus delicti fills an important gap. It's not filled in any other area. I think the decisions going back to Hooker, Hyatt, which is the Fifth District,
you record in the next couple of minutes? I'm interested in the corroboration versus corpus delicti rule distinction and the Hooker case in particular and how it applies. And also, if you could comment for the students on why it's not fair to change the rules mid-game.
We'll give you another 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'll let the students first.
Yes. I'm sorry to interrupt your argument like this.
No, that's quite right. It's
One of the things that Justice Gassman addresses is why it would be unfair to change the rule on this case. And I guess I'm not an expert in that area, but my answer would be that we're all operating under our system laws, and even if a law were to change, the most fair thing to do is to apply the law as it sat. Sort of a basketball game, if halfway through the game they started awarding 3 points per shot instead of two, that kind of thing, where the idea would be that a cop should be judged according to the law as it is now and not as it might be changed. I think that's what. And then I guess I was addressing the issue of the fifth and sixth, and I mentioned Parker, and you made a reference. I didn't even catch what you were.
But my question to you is, under Hooker and Edwards, Nevada has declared itself repeatedly to be a corpus delicti rule state, even though that rule is not statutorily provided for in Nevada and it does not come from the Constitution. My question to you, and you're on track with the distinction between corroboration versus corpus delicti rule and the fact that some more modern cases are saying corpus delicti is obsolete except perhaps in the murder or other conventional common law crime settings. I wanted to hear from you on why you think the corpus delicti rule should be retained and still has importance notwithstanding the Fifth and Sixth Amendment jurisprudence.
Absolutely. In a broader and philosophical sense, I made the references to the Soviet Union. That's sort of a pet area of mine. That's obviously much more the hypothetical and philosophical, but as a practical matter, I think it's a good thing that we require proof that the crime happened and that someone can be convicted based on their statements. And if you were to remove corpus delicti, that's pretty much what would happen, because in this case, you have statements, and then you can add some other information, which if you put them on top of the statements, might be enough for a jury. But the fact of the matter is that if you leave the statements out, I don't think that there's sufficient evidence in this case to draw a reasonable inference that the crime occurred. And it is a tough one, it is an unusual one, like the state said, but the overriding principle is more important than the particulars of a given case. And I don't think that we need to move in the direction of encouraging less police work and more reliance on confessions.
Thank you, Mr. Robia. Thank you, Mr. Friel. Students, can we give these attorneys a round of applause? They've been a fabulous job. Very impressed with an excellent defense attorney and an excellent prosecutor. Mr. Kunze, you got a good guy here.